All right, we're ready for Deuteronomy 15 and 16 as we make our way through this great book. We are in this second major section, the second sermon still. It's a longer sermon, at least as it is recorded here in the text, which will carry us through chapter 26. As Baxter has outlined it here, it has to do with the testimonies, the statutes, and the judgments, and we are in the second section of that. And more about that as we go along. Let's review where we've been, and then we'll get underway with chapter 15. Chapter 1, this is the first sermon. What happened in the first chapter? All right, reviewed that trip and that traveling, the journeying from Sinai to Kadesh. Chapter 2. All right, very good. Yes, at the wilderness wanderings and then victory over Sihon. He was the first king to be conquered on the east side of the Jordan River. Now, when that we mention Sihon, that automatically makes us think of another king usually mentioned in connection. Og, which is in the next chapter. The victory over Og and then the division of the land and Moses forbidden to enter. This sermon ends on what note, chapter 4? All right, obedience to the law, the necessity thereof. All right, chapter 5, what's it about? Ten Commandments, and the people fear God. Chapter 6. All right, yeah, the significance of what the law is all about. And so here's its place, its purpose, its warning. Things are going to go well if you heed the law. We see that over and over through the book of Deuteronomy. Chapter 7. They are a separate people. Chapter 8. All right, yes. Chapter 8, keeping the commandments of God. So notice that theme, he keeps coming back to that again and again. That's really what the book of Deuteronomy is about. If you get on the other side of the river, we cross over, you're going to have to keep the commandments if things are going to go well. That's the basic bottom line of all these sermons. That's the theme of, as Smith called it, the 30-day revival, as he called it. That's the theme of the whole series. Chapter 9. Yeah, you're not going to get there by your own self. It's by the help of God. Chapter 10. All right, yes. Mercy and obedience here. Again, here comes that theme of obedience. Chapter 11. All right, here's what it means to love and obey the Lord. Chapter 12. Worship as God directs. What stands out about chapter 12 that we keep seeing again and we see it again tonight? That's the chapter where God said, you will worship where I choose, at the place where I choose. Where was that place? Shiloh at first, later Jerusalem. So wherever the tabernacle is going to be and ultimately the temple. All right, chapter 13. Idolatry, the destruction of those that lead to idolatry. Even if that's a person that's near you, kin to you, close to you, you're going to identify them and we're going to deal with them. Hard command to obey. Chapter 14 now, last one. All right. Don't mourn like the heathens, and here are clean and unclean animals. These are part of the statutes that we've been talking about so far. Question number one for tonight, chapter 11. What's chapter 11 about? I mean, not chapter 11, 15. Very good. Thank you. Chapter 15. All right. The 7-year release is what chapter 15 is about. What's 16 about? Same question. All right. Annual feast. Three annual feasts that are dealt with, and then there's just judges. All right. Let's talk about the 7-year release. This is not the same as the year of Jubilee, but this is the 7-year release of debt and treatment of the poor, etc. So let's get underway. In fact, let's get a question or two out of the way before we look at that. Question number two, what happened to debt every 7 years? It was, the term is used. Yeah, it's forgiven or it's released. More about the meaning of that. There's some controversy over that. We'll talk about the significance of that here in just a moment. Question number three, what's the reason given for not borrowing from other nations? All right. Yeah, they'll reign over you. If you are indebted to them, they'll control you. They have some control, somehow. And we'll say more about that. It's a biblical principle. We'll talk more about that principle a little bit later. Let's get question number four. What was the law concerning lending to the poor? Verses 7 through 11. Approach them with open hand. What? Open hand. Very good. All right, let's get underway here. Chapter 15, verses 1 to 5. This has to do with debt being canceled, or, as some have thought, and we'll get to what that controversy is, debt delayed. What is this talking about? We'll talk about the arguments for that here in a second. So let's start here with verse 1. At the end of 7 years, there was a release of the debt. I like using the terminology of the text, that it was released. And then whatever interpretation you may put on it should fit that term. Versus saying, as I've put here, canceled may not be the correct terminology, but here's the release of the debt. So at the end of every 7 years, you shall grant a release of debts. All right? That's verse 1. Now, there's two things about the creditor that's mentioned here. First of all, verse 2, the creditor may not require of the neighbor or his brother. And so this is the form of the release. In other words, here's how it works. This is what it's going to look like. Every creditor that has lent anything to his neighbor shall release it and shall not require it. Or, as your footnote may say, he may not exact it. We'll come back to that. Of his neighbor or his brother, because it is called the Lord's release. All right, verse 3. Of a foreigner you may require it, but your hand shall not release, or shall release, what is owed by your brother. So you've loaned money to, if you are a Jew and you live in that time that you have crossed over into the river, over the river, and we've conquered the land now, and you've loaned to your brother, to your neighbor. At the end of 7 years, that is released, whatever that means. But if you've loaned to a foreigner, you could demand it of him. You don't release it with him. Now let's go ahead and get 4 and 5, and then we'll come back and talk about what verse 2 is actually talking about. The wording of verse 4, particularly in the King James and the New King James, is a little odd. The New King James says, except when there is no poor among you. It almost sounds, and the King James even is a little worse. I'm not saying it's a bad translation. I'm just saying that it leaves an impression that in cases where there is no poor among you. And yet verse 11 said, there'll always be poor. So that must not be what it means. I think what it's talking about is it's to prevent furtherance of poverty. Barnes suggests it prevents the total ruin of the poor. So this release of the debt, it is going to be the poor that have been borrowing, and the poor is not the creditor, the poor is the one who are borrowing. And so at the end of 7 years, whatever the release means, they're released of that debt, and that is to prevent the total ruin of those who are poor. Now, who has the English Standard, and so I don't have to look it up? Anybody got the English? Read that for us. Verse 4. All right, so it's a little bit different. Somebody get the New American Standard. Who's got? All right, I'm going to come back to you in just a minute. Hang on. That sounds a little better from the standpoint of the point I'm trying to drive here, that I don't think it's saying, here's an exception, when there is no poor among you, then you don't, this doesn't apply. That sounds like the New King James and King James. I think it's saying it's to prevent the total ruin of the poor. In other words, it's to prevent the poor. And so they're borrowing and they're paying, And at the end of 7 years, you release them of that, and that is to prevent furtherance of poverty. Now the New American Standard, I believe it is the one I'm wanting. I'm not sure. Let's see. I don't think, and that's, yeah, that's the one I was looking for.
However, there should not be any poor among you.
Yeah. Which translation was that?
That's NET.
NET, all right. Those are not saying, I do not think, in light of verse 11, there's not going to be any poor at all. It is to prevent poverty or creating more poor. Does that make sense? It is to keep from preventing a furtherance of that or driving them further down. So picture yourself as the poor and you've borrowed and you're struggling and you got a release of your debt, whether it's a temporary thing or it's a permanent thing. Either way, that helps further you so that you do not be overcome by your debt. Does that make sense? All right, yeah, good point. Now, in the sabbatical year, there was no sowing or reaping according to Exodus 23 and Leviticus 25. That comes to play here as well, and I'll just leave that hanging for what that may be worth to you. But does that make sense, what we're saying about the preventing of the poverty? Now, let's go back and talk about verse 2. There is division among commentators as to what that's talking about, and on the surface, it sounds like perhaps a complete release of the debt. And so Kaufman and others argue that this is a complete release of the debt. So at the end of 7 years, there's a complete release of the debt. So I don't know how much would be, it'd be varying amounts, but suppose the poor had borrowed $5,000 and to live on, and at the he borrowed it at the fifth year, and 2 years later, then he's just completely released and he owes nothing. Maybe he's only paid a portion of that back, $1,000, and it's just all given to him. Well, maybe that's what that's talking about. Others argue, Lang and others, and Kyle and Daitlich argue that this release is not a release from the obligation of the debt. The debt's still there, but the payment for that year. And they argue on the basis of this word that is translated at verse 2, you shall not require it of his neighbor. That is, the debt's still there, but for that year, you do not require payment of that. So he has a year's freedom. Well, if that's the case, there is still some relief. If you are paying a mortgage on your house, on your car, and you're given a free year that you still have the debt, but you get a free year, you don't make any payments. That's kind of nice. That's kind of helpful. And that gives you a chance to catch up on some other things. Which is it? I'm not sure. I kind of lean toward it may be the release of the payment for that year. Now, one of the things that Kyle argues, Kyle and Daitlich, I believe they're the ones that argue this, that later in the context, where the creditor is encouraged not to back off from loaning the money because this seventh year is coming up. So here it is on the fifth year, fifth and a half year, or sixth year, and he needs to borrow some money. He argues, Kyle, I believe it was arguing, that nobody would ever want to loan money in the late years if it's going to be a complete release. But he would go forward knowing that it's just a release for that year. Does that make sense? You may disagree with that. Have at it. I'm not going to argue the case. I'm just giving you the reasons behind that. All right. Yes.
My translation
says,
he shall not exact it.
Yeah. Same thing. The same. The word can be translated to exact. Means to take from. It's used that way in Nehemiah. Nehemiah 5. And here it is used in the sense of taking, he's released from the debt and you don't take it from him. Now, I'm not convinced that word solely means just a temporary. That word could be used, you don't exact it from him because he's released completely of the debt, or you don't exact it from him because he's released for a year. That word doesn't tell me that within itself. I think that's a safe conclusion. All right, let's pick up now at verse 6. At verse 6, it gets to the lending of the poor. One of the commentators made this observation that basically the lending to the poor ultimately becomes, in many cases, not always, giving to the poor. And perhaps you've experienced that. How many times has somebody that was really in need and in poverty wanted to borrow money and you loaned them money knowing you probably wouldn't get it back? But you loaned it to them because they need the obligation of paying, but they may never pay it back. Have you ever done that? It may not be anything but $20, or it may be $100, but I'll loan that to you, but I'm not going to give it to you. I'm going to loan it to you because I want you to have the responsibility of needing some responsibility of paying it back, knowing I'll probably never see it. And so in that case, what have you done? You give it to them. And maybe that's what's going on here. Starting at verse 6 now, let's talk about verse 6. You lend but don't borrow from the nations, meaning the foreigners, the heathen. Why is that the case? Stephen's already mentioned this earlier, but let's go back to that principle. So they don't rule over you. You might make a marginal note, Proverbs 22:7, the borrower is servant to the lender. Remember that passage? The borrower is servant to the lender. If you borrow from someone, you just became their slave and their servant in some shape, form, or fashion. And the more we borrow from another country, whether it's as a country or as individual, but if we borrow from China and keep borrowing from China, we are indebted to China. They become our ruler. That's a basic principle. It's a biblical principle. The same thing is true. You borrow $1 million from the bank, you are indebted to them. And maybe you can pay it back, but maybe you've indebted yourself so that now you're a slave to them. That's the principle. So don't let them rule over you in that way. Now, 7 and 8, what's the point in 7 and 8? There is going to be poor among you. So verse 4 is not telling me there's not going to be poor. It doesn't prevent all poverty. All right, you help them. You lend to the poor, that if there's poor among you and among your brethren within your gates, and you're not to harden your heart nor shut your hand. Notice the terminology of shutting your hand, and later we'll see an open hand. Don't shut your hand to him, but open your hand wide, giving him whatever he needs. All right? So basically all I've learned from 7 and 8, lend to the poor. He's in need. You lend to him. Whatever he needs, you give it to him. Don't deny it of him. And so this is an obligation. All right, what's the point of 7 and 9 through 11? Don't have... Absolutely. Notice he calls that wicked thought. What JP just described is a wicked thought. In other words, yeah, you are going to be cautious, and you're going to be thinking, here it is, the fifth year, the sixth year, and the seventh year, they're released, whether that's released of payment or complete. The same principle is there. And so you're thinking, I don't think I'm going to loan to him. That's a wicked thought in your heart. That's a wicked thought, and that's an evil eye. According to verse 9, and he'll cry out against you and it becomes sin. So you're going to do him wrong. He needs the money. You are obligated to loan that to him. Interesting, no New Testament. The New Testament talks about helping the poor and being kind. I don't know of any New Testament principle says if somebody wants to borrow from you and their brother in the Lord, you're obligated to give to them. Does anybody know of a passage that mentions that? I'm not a knowledge of one. Helping the needy, yes. But if they ask for a loan, always give them a loan. I don't know of that. I don't know of a New Testament principle anywhere about that. If you think of one, let me know. Now notice at verse 10, you should surely give him what he wants, and be grieved when you give to him. What does that mean? Yeah, giving grudgingly, fretting about that, and complaining about that, because this is the thing of the Lord, this is the thing the Lord your God will bless you in all your works to which you put your hand. This is one of the things that when you do it, God's going to bless you because you did do that. This is a commandment of the Lord. And so he's driving home the principle of obedience all through this sermon. This is one of them. So when somebody needs, you lend to them. And then verse 11 is quoted multiple times in the New Testament. By multiple times, it's the same occasion, or at least two different occasions, but it's quoted by the Lord. For the poor will never cease from the land. Jesus quoted it as saying, the poor you have with you always. So this is the passage he was referring to, most likely. You're to open your hand wide to your brother, your poor, your needy of your land. So in other words, you give to him regardless of how close you're getting to that seventh year. To me, I agree. I'm going to go back and argue a little more for that second view, that probably I'm leaning more toward Kyle and Dalich being correct on that, that it probably had to do with a temporary release for the year, because I think it would be difficult, extremely difficult for one to loan on that sixth year, the fifth year, even the fourth year, knowing that this is going to be all wiped out before he has much time to make much payment. Does that make sense? That doesn't mean you have to agree with that. That's just, I think, part of the strong, Kyle's strong argument. All right, let's begin at verse 12 now. What do we have at verse 12? This is not the debt, but this is the release of servants in the seventh year. So they're to be released in the seventh year. If your brother, a Hebrew man or Hebrew woman, is sold to you. Now, under what circumstance would one brother be buying another brother? Because of their debts. It's why it's in the context. Exodus 21, verses 2 through 6, hints at this idea, as well as other texts. 2 Kings alludes to this principle. Remember, Ahab sold himself to do evil? It alludes to the principle of one selling themselves into slavery. Because of an enormous amount of debt, the only way I can take care of my family is to sell myself to this master who can pay an enormous sum so that I can live on that. And that was with the agreement, I am your slave for life, or however long you want to keep me. And until the seventh year rolls around. So he just sold himself. So at verse 12, what's to be done with him? He's set free. Now, I hate to keep going back to the principle of verse 2. Some argue that this release is parallel to the release of the funds. And this was not a temporary release, but this was a complete release of the prisoner or of the slave. And so that must be a complete release over there. Not a bad argument. You can play with that as you wish. Now, beginning at verse 13, what's his point through verse 15? And then he mentions it again at verse 18. Yeah, send him away. He's released. Let him go in the seventh year. And you don't send him away empty-handed. So you give him part of your flock, off your threshing floor, your wine press. In other words, give him wine, give him grain, give him flocks. Let him get a start in life. And the driving force, verse 15, what's going to be the driving force here? Yeah. Remember, you were slaves. And God brought you out and God took care of you. You release him and let him go and you take care of him. And so you release him. All right, now verse 16 and 17. This is not new material. We've seen this before. Exodus 21. He may decide. All right, he may decide he wants to stay. Not all slavery, not all servitude was harsh and mean and degrading. He may want to stay because, verse 17, he loves you and your house. Man, he feels a part of the family. I've been here for years. I've worked for you for a long time. And this is the family I've got. And so I love you and I love your family. And he prospers with you. He's done well, did well there because he sold himself because he wasn't doing well. I'm prospering quite well. I'm doing well in your household. And so he says, I want to stay. What do you do? You let him stay, but there's going to be, verse 17. All right. Yeah, you take an awl and thrust it through his ear at the door, public ceremony, which is declaring and putting an identifying mark that he is your permanent slave. He's staying forever. And so he chose to stay. That was his decision. And so you keep him, and so he's not released in the 6 years. Now, verse 18, you're sending him away, and one of the driving forces is, remember, you were in Egypt, but there was another driving force. Why you send him away with not empty-handed? He had been a good servant. In fact, he had been better than a double hired servant in those 6 years. So he's worked for you for 6 years, and in the seventh year you're going to release him. He was worth more than two men. He was a good servant. Let him go. Particularly the one who sold himself to you. He's going to work hard. All right. So what's going on here? This is the principles we've been talking about throughout the statutes. And what he's saying is, when you get across over into the land, here are things that are going to come to play. You're going to have servants. You're going to have the poor. You're going to release your servants. You're going to release the debt. You're going to have people selling themselves to you because of their debt. Here's what's going to happen every 7 years, et cetera. Here's the laws that come into play. Here are the statutes that you got to remember when you get across over in the land. Make sense? All right. Now, there's one more thing in chapter 15, and that's the law of the firstborn flocks. This is not new ground. We came across this in Exodus 13, verse 2, and in verse 12. So let's see what goes on here. Verses 19 and 20, what's the point? All right. Yeah, here's the firstborn of the flock that's set aside and dedicated to the Lord. And you'll sanctify them to the Lord. And so that animal is not going to be used for labor or for profit. And so you say, well, where do you get the profit? You're not going to work with him. You're not going to work that animal. Nor are you going to shear the firstborn of your flock. Meaning, you're not going to shear them so that you're making some money off of them. You're not going to, well, let's shear them and get all we can off of them. Then we give them to the Lord. You're not going to do that. You're giving the complete animal his whole usefulness to the Lord. And look at verse 20. You and your household shall eat it before the Lord your God year by year in the place which the Lord chooses. Now, that is an addendum to the law we already saw in Exodus 13. Because that wasn't mentioned in Exodus 13. Why wasn't the place where the Lord chooses mentioned in Exodus 13? Not ready to go in the land, and it wasn't mentioned till this point, which is at the end of the wilderness journeyings at Deuteronomy chapter 12. Yes, very good. All right. 19 and 20 make sense. All the firstborn are going to be sanctified, and you're going to take it, and you're going to eat it as part of that dedication, but you're going to eat that at Shiloh, if that be where they land, and it is, and then ultimately be Jerusalem. Does that make sense? You're going to eat this where the Lord chooses. So he's adding an addendum to the law of Exodus 13. All right, let's get 21 to 23, see what we have there. What happens in 21 to 23? Sometimes the firstborn may be defective somehow. It may be lame, it may be blind, or it may have a serious defect, and you're not going to sacrifice that to the Lord. Let's just stop right there. What does that tell us about the service of the Lord? God deserves the best. And so you're going to sacrifice your firstborn, the best, to the Lord. But what about this animal that has the defect in it? Maybe it's deformed. Maybe it's blind. The meat's still good. Yeah, you can eat it yourself. Even the unclean as well as the clean person may eat it as if it were a gazelle or a deer. So you can eat it within your gates. You're not going to eat it at the place where the Lord chooses, the place of worship where the tabernacle is or the temple. But you're going to eat it within your own gates. Eat it at home. Does that make sense? But there's one rule he reminds them of. What is it? Verse 23. You're not going to eat any blood, but you're going to do what with it? Pour it out. Why couldn't they eat blood? He doesn't tell us here. Life's in the blood. That's found in Leviticus Leviticus, not in the first 16 chapters, not from chapter 18 on. 17. Yeah, there we go. All right, so here's what we have. Chapter 15. Debt canceled, lending to the poor, release of the servants, and here's the law of the firstborn. Do you see that emphasis of the statutes that we've been talking about in this subsection? Questions or comments on chapter 15? Let's go to chapter 16 now. There are three annual feasts that are mentioned here. So I want to get ahead of ourselves. Let's jump on over in the chapter. We're going to come back to verse 1. But let's jump down to verse 16. At verse 16 is a summary of these three annual feasts. Now, is that the only feast they had? I'll have a slide up in a moment noticing a numerous feast that they had throughout the year. But three times, let's get it, verse 16, three times a year, all your males shall appear before the Lord your God in the place where he chooses. Deuteronomy 12. And here they are, the Feast of the Unleavened Bread, number one, the Feast of Weeks, and the Feast of Tabernacles. They shall not appear before the Lord empty-handed. And we'll come back to those verses in a moment. So here's what's going to happen is we're going to make our way to the place that God chooses three times a year, all males. Make sense? Well, now, this is not new ground. There are some new information here. This is not new ground. So let's talk about the Feast of the Passover. So verses 1 through 8 deal with the Feast of the Passover. So let's go to question number 6. What was the Feast of the Passover? Verses 1 to 8. All right, very good. Remember the 10th plague? In the 10th plague, the firstborn among all the Egyptians were killed. And if they put blood on the doorpost, the Israelites did, God would pass over them. And so here the Passover, the Feast of the Passover, was a remembrance of God passing over their firstborn so that they were not killed in the 10th plague. Does that make sense? No new ground here as far as just the Feast of the Passover. Now let's start with verse 1 and talk about the when. And you might get ready to, if you jump over to, hold a finger here at Deuteronomy 16, let's jump over to Exodus 13. And you may have a note about this at Exodus 13 and in verse 4. The month here is identified as the month of Abib. And at Exodus 13, 4, we saw that and we made a note. And you may have a note that that's actually the month Nisan, which is this month right here. Corresponding right there within my circle is Nisan. This is the Passover. Corresponding with the beginning, our mid-March through mid-April. All right? So that was the name Abib means the month of the young ears and grain, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown in Pulpit. But that's the same month that's Nisan. Make sense? So don't get excited. You say, well, I don't see Nisan in the text. It was named different by the time we get to the book of Nehemiah. Begin to call it by a different name. Make sense? All right. So that's the when this takes place, according to our text. Now, verse 2 and verses 5 through 7 talk about the where. This was observed previously. This was to be observed previous to this point, this sermon. This was to be observed at home. So here is an addendum to the law. This hadn't been mentioned in the book of Exodus. Exodus 12 mentions this, Exodus 13, Leviticus 23, and Numbers 28 and 29. None of those mentioned in the place where the Lord chooses. At least I don't remember it. This is added here. So look at verse 2. You should take this sacrifice to the place where the Lord chooses to put his name. Now drop down, that's verse 2. We're going to skip verses 3 and 4. Look at verse 5. Again, You may not sacrifice the Passover within your gates, but at a place where the Lord chooses. That's Deuteronomy chapter 12. And you'll sacrifice the Passover at twilight. Verse 7 is more about the where. You shall roast and eat it in the place where the Lord your God chooses. In the morning you shall turn and go to your tents. In other words, you're going to observe it and then go back to your tents the next morning. So he tells us the when and the where. Let's talk about the something that goes along with that. This is not actually the Passover. The term Passover sometimes encompassed the whole feast. But the Passover was actually one thing followed by another portion. And that's the feast of the unleavened bread. So what happens in verses 3 and 4? That's the feast that followed. Now let's go back to our map right here, our calendar. Notice you have the Passover begins on the 15th month of Abib, or Nisan, and then that was followed by a seven-day feast. And that was the Feast of Unleavened Bread. They were viewed together because that was one of the annual feasts. Those were not two separate, they're separate things, but that's the first annual feast. Does that make sense? It's being listed here in our context. All right. What do you see about the Feast of Unleavened Bread? Verses 3 and 4, and then verse 8. Say again. Yeah. There's not to be any leaven at all be found, thus the unleavened bread. Why is this being done? Because they left Egypt in haste. They left Egypt in haste. And remember the day that you came out of Egypt. And there'll be no leaven seen for 7 days. And meat that you eat on the sacrifice of the Passover is not to remain till twilight. Verse 8 to finish that. 6 days you'll eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh day shall be a sacred assembly to the Lord your God, and you shall do no work. Now, that doesn't tell us all we need to know about the Passover, but I know this is kind of small print. I don't even remember what my source of this. I think this may have come off of one of my sources of Lagos. But the Passover started on the 14th, and then on the 15th through the 21st was this commemoration of the hasty hurrying out of Egypt. So that's a little of what went on in that first annual feast. All right, let's talk about the second one mentioned here, which is called what? The Feast of Weeks, also known as Pentecost. All right, so let's get ahead of ourselves here and find Pentecost. It is in the month of Sivan, which is right here. So you have Nisan, and then 2 months later is we have Pentecost, which would be late May for us. All right. What do we know about the Feast of Pentecost? Question number 7. It was also known as the Feast of the Wheat Harvest. What was its purpose? Here we are right here. If you may not can read this, some of you have got these slides ahead of time. Yeah, to dedicate and consecrate the first fruits of the wheat harvest. And so that was the purpose of that. And so here is the Feast of Harvest, or the Feast of Weeks, or Pentecost. Now let's back up and get some details. Verse 9 is the when. It would be numbered after 7 weeks. It was actually penti, meaning 50. It was a feast of 50 days. Count 7 Sabbaths and add 1. So the Feast of the Pentecost always fell on the first day of the week. And hence, Acts 2 was on the first day of the week. So here's what they're to do. Look at verse 10 and 11. Here's the offering that you bring. In the Feast of Weeks, there's the freewill offering from your hand. You shall give it to the Lord. You shall rejoice and bring it in. But I'm more interested right now, in interest of time, at verse 12. We know when, we know where, we know what was to be offered at this annual feast that all the males went to. What does verse 12 say? Remember, you were slaves in Egypt, and you shall be, there's a word we've been looking for. Careful. Might underline that. It's not the only time we'll see it. But be careful, he said. Be careful to observe that. All right. What does that tell you? What do you learn from that? This is part of the statutes that he's reminding them of. You get into the land. If you want things to go well, you need to be careful to observe every command. That includes the Passover. That includes the Feast of Weeks. That includes every other feast you have. Making sense? Carefully observe that and observe these statutes. All right. Questions or comments? All right. Now notice I have highlighted here the three major annual feasts. These two go together as one. The second is Pentecost. And the third one is down here is the Feast of Tabernacles. So let's talk about the Tabernacles. Let's talk about when that would take place. That's found at verse 13 and 14. The specifics are not all given there, but it was a Feast of Tabernacles was for 7 days. When you have gathered from your threshing floor and from your wine press. All right, so the Feast of the Tabernacles took place over here in late September for us, in Tishri, the month of Tishri. And so here we are, right here, the Feast of Tabernacles, right at this point, a Feast of 7 days. Now, there were other feasts, but that's one of the three annual feasts. Make sense? One of the three major feasts they went to. All right, what else do we know about what took place at the Feast of Tabernacles? How long did it last? Verse 13, verse 15, for 7 days. What took place? What was this all about? Yeah, it was you may not can again read this small print here, but it was commemorating God's deliverance and protection during the wilderness wanderings. They would dwell in booths. Do you remember the book of Nehemiah? That's one of the things in Ezra and Nehemiah, that time period, they forgot about that, and were not practicing that, and on the preaching of Ezra, they learned that they were neglecting that, and they began to start dwelling in booths. So brush arbor kind of tents. They would take their brush and make their tent and dwell in it to remember the difficulties of the wilderness wanderings. Now, we've already talked about verse 16. I want to go back to that slide just for a moment. Let me go back and... here we go, right here. The three annual feasts are mentioned, and then every man shall give as he is able according to the blessing that God has given him. So you're going to go to these annual feasts. You don't go empty-handed. You go, verse 16 mentioned that again. We already saw that earlier. You're not going to go empty-handed. You're going to take things to offer to the Lord, be it your firstborn, be it whatever it is that you have. You take that and offer that before the Lord. Now let's talk about the just judges. And then we'll wind up here in a couple of minutes. What do you see in 18 to 22? There are going to be judges in every region or village. In other words, there's not going to be just judges at Jerusalem or at Shiloh. They're going to be basically in every village, though the term village is not used here. Appoint judges and officers throughout your gates. In all your gates. And so, in other words, in every village, in every area, you're going to go in and appoint these judges. Now, verse 19 and 20, how are they to judge? Righteously, yes. There's going to be just judgment. They're not going to pervert justice nor take a bribe because that blinds the eyes of wisdom and twists the words of the righteous. Now, verse 20 to 22, verse 21 and 22. Let's go back to verse 20. You shall follow what is altogether just. For what reason? Same thing Deuteronomy 6 said, that it may go well with you in the land. That's not exactly what it said, but that's the meaning of that. Let's quickly get 21 and 22. What's the judging have to do with this? That's one of the areas where they will pass judgment, and they'll be careful to judge, to watch for the building of planting yourself a tree as a wooden image. You're supposed to tear down the idols, the wooden images, but here's a man plants a tree and watches it grow that he might make an image out of that. A judge is going to take care of that. He should watch for that. Does that make sense? He's going to watch for things that lead to idolatry. Nothing wrong with growing the tree, but if it's with the intent of making a wooden image, near the altar, which is built for yourself, so don't have the altar of God, and then something going on over here that could easily be made into an idol. Judges are going to rule on that. I take that in because of the close proximity of 21 and 22 to the judges, that's part of what they're judging on. And you should not set up a sacred pillar which the Lord God hates. Make sense? So part of this is sounding like much of Leviticus. We're getting into those statutes. That's part of what Moses is reminding them of. This is what you're going to have to observe. This is what you're going to do. Questions or comments? Let's get one or two practical lessons. We have, our time is about gone. What have you learned from these chapters that you take home with you? Careful obedience, verse 5 of chapter 15, verse 12 of chapter 16. What else? Yeah, God wants us to take care of the poor. You had one there? Yeah. Always do what the Lord says. One more and we're done. Practical lesson. Nobody? Good point. Good point. We'll end on that. Chapter 17, 18, next time.